Welcome to the deep dive. You know, if you've ever looked at your dog and just thought, how did we get so lucky? Well, today we might just have the answer for you. We're moving past the warm, fuzzy feelings, the anecdotes, and really digging into the science. We're talking neurobiology, genetics, behavioral research, the stuff that explains this incredible bond between humans and dogs. So our mission today, it's pretty straightforward. We're not asking if the relationship is special. I mean, we all know it is, right? We're asking how. How are the dog's brain and genes actually wired for this connection? And maybe, for us humans, what are the real tangible effects on our own well-being?
Yeah, and we've got some fascinating sources lined up. We're going to look at everything from, that famous Russian fox experiment, which really changed how we think about domestication, to these incredible fMRI scans of awake dog brains reacting to smells, and even the sometimes surprising and frankly contradictory findings about oxytocin, the so-called love hormone. Essentially, what we're doing is tracing the whole story from the genetic pressures that shape dogs way back, through the brain systems that handle reward, right up to how they affect our emotions day to day.
Okay, let's unpack that blueprint then. Where do we start? I guess the big question first time. Did humans deliberately, breed dogs over centuries to understand us, like pointing and stuff? Or was that amazing skill just like a happy accident of wanting a tamer wolf around?
Well, the evidence we have now really points towards it being more of an accident, the side effect. It's called the correlated byproduct hypothesis. The idea is, think about it. Early humans probably weren't thinking, I need a dog that understands my gestures. They were likely selecting against the scary stuff, fear, aggression, and just picking the animals that were, tamer, more comfortable being near people.
And the ability to read our cues just tagged along.
Exactly. It came along for the ride. The primary selection was for tameness, for sociability.
And the big proof for this is that incredible Russian fox experiment. It's almost legendary in biology.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for nearly 50 years, researchers in Siberia were breeding silver foxes based only on how tame they were towards humans. No training to follow cues, nothing like that. Just selecting for friendliness, generation after generation. And when they tested these specially bred tame foxes, they were just as good at using a human pointing or looking somewhere to find hidden food as actual dog puppies are.
Wow. As good as puppies raised for that sort of thing.
Just as good. And here's the kicker. They were significantly better at it than the control group of foxes, the ones who hadn't been bred for tameness.
So you just make them nicer, less scared, and bam, suddenly they unlock this social skill that looks exactly like what we think is special about dogs.
Precisely. It wasn't about directly engineering communication skills. It was about changing their underlying emotional response to us. And this lines up perfectly with what we're now seeing in the genetics of modern dogs, specifically around something called hypersociability, or HYP. Researchers have found these big changes, structural variants, in the genes on a particular part of canine chromosome 6.
Okay, chromosome 6, that sounds technical. Slow down a bit. Why is that specific spot important for, someone listening?
Well, what's really fascinating is that this region in dogs corresponds, it's orthologous, to a region in the human genome linked to Williams-Beuren syndrome, WBS.
Williams-Beuren syndrome. Hang on, quick definition. What is that?
All right, so WBS is a human genetic condition. It's complex, but one of the really defining features is this intense, almost overwhelming drive for social interaction, extreme friendliness, often less fear of strangers. And the genes involved there, like GTF2I and GTF2IRD1, they're involved in controlling other genes, and they're directly implicated in that super sociable phenotype in people with WBS.
Whoa, okay, so the genetics are suggesting that domestication basically found that same genetic dial for sociability and just cranked it way up in dogs.
That's exactly what the research points to.
So we weren't breeding them necessarily to be geniuses at reading us, but more like emotional magnets, animals that just really, really want to be around us.
That seems to be the core of it. It's less about abstract intelligence and more about this powerful innate motivation to seek out human social contact. That's the genetic foundation.
Okay, so that's the blueprint. How does this actually play out in a dog's brain day to day, especially using their, most powerful sense?
Yep. Right. Now let's look inside the living brain. There's this fantastic fMRI study, and getting data like this is incredibly difficult. They use 12 dogs, fully awake, not sedated, not restrained, inside an MRI scanner.
Just getting a dog to do that is an achievement.
It really is a testament to the training and the dog's temperament. So the researchers wanted to know what smell triggers the biggest reward signal in the dog's brain. They focused on a key area, the caudate nucleus. Think of it as part of the brain's reward circuit. It lights up when anticipating something good, something positive. It's like the dog's internal yes button.
And they tested different smells.
Five key ones. The dog's own scent, a strange dog scent, a familiar dog scent, a strange human scent, and critically, the scent of a familiar human. What would you guess triggered the biggest response? Maybe the familiar dog.
You'd think so, right? Fellow dog, part of the pack, maybe.
That's what you might expect. But the results were stunning. The caudate nucleus activated most strongly, maximally, to the familiar human scent. Yeah, this response was significantly bigger than the reaction to a strange human. And importantly, it was also significantly stronger than the response to the scent of a familiar dog.
That's profound. The dog's own brain is basically telling us, through its reward system, that the smell of their human is the single most valuable, most anticipated thing in their environment, more than another dog.
It lights up their internal pleasure center more than anything else tested. And here's another fascinating detail.
Go on.
The familiar human who provided this scent, often it wasn't the dog's main owner or handler. It might have been, say, the handler's husband or their child, someone else living in the house.
So it wasn't just my primary person.
No. It shows the dog could clearly identify that specific person's scent, and it formed this incredibly positive reward-linked association with them, even just from their smell when they weren't even there. The scent itself represented something highly rewarding, almost abstractly.
Okay, so we've got the genetic push towards hypersociability and a brain reward system that's basically centered on familiar humans. That connects the internal wiring to, well, the outside world. How does this bond actually function? We know they're wired for it, but what about us? Let's flip the script. What happens to our bodies and minds when we interact with them?
Well, first, remember, dogs are incredibly good at reading us. They pick up on human emotional signals, our faces, our posture, the sound of our voice, maybe even our smell. And this isn't just passive observation, it's functional. They use that information to figure out what we might do next, and it helps guide their own behavior. They're constantly reading the room, so to speak.
And when they read that room and maybe sense distress, what's the actual measurable effect on the person feeling that stress? Let's talk about that university student study. College students often dealing with a lot of anxiety, right?
Exactly, a high-stress population. This study took 82 students and split them. One group got direct, hands-on interaction with a therapy dog, a trained 2-year-old golden retriever, petting, talking, just being with the dog. The other group, the control, they just watched a video of that same dog.
Okay, so physical contact versus just watching.
Right. Now, interestingly, both groups showed some positive effects. Just watching the dog video led to a small decrease in anxiety and negative feelings compared to baseline. So even passively viewing a dog can be a little calming.
But the real difference came with the hands-on group. What did that physical interaction do?
A huge difference. It was statistically significant. The students who physically interacted with the dog showed much, much greater drops in their anxiety and sadness levels.
Okay, reduced anxiety, reduced sadness.
But it wasn't just taking away the negative. They also showed significantly greater increases in positive feelings, specifically scores for joviality and happiness. It wasn't just calming them down. It actively boosted their positive mood in a way that just watching the video couldn't.
That's concrete proof, then. The physical presence, the interaction, gives us a measurable emotional lift, an actual happiness boost.
A quantifiable effect, yes.
Now, we can't really talk about the human-dog bond without hitting on the big one, the oxytocin loop. You see it everywhere. Popular science articles, documentaries saying that cuddling your dog releases this love hormone in both of you, reinforcing the connection.
Yes, oxytocin. This is where things get, well, a bit more complicated, actually. It raises a really important question about how consistent that effect truly is.
Wait, complicated? Why? It sounds so neat. The brain's reward center lights up with the human scent. We feel happier when we pet them. Shouldn't the neurochemistry follow that nice feedback loop? Are you saying the science isn't quite as clear-cut as the headlines suggest?
I am saying the scientific picture is, frankly, quite messy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a notable study that specifically looked at this. They took 20 women and their dogs. They had them do a typical positive interaction for 15 minutes, cuddling, stroking, looking into each other's eyes. Then they measured oxytocin levels in both the women and the dogs using urine samples, which is a standard, non-invasive way to do it.
Okay, makes sense. So what did they find, the expected oxytocin spike?
Well, here's the thing. Overall, in that particular study, they found that neither who the interaction partner was, their owner versus just a familiar person, nor the type of positive interaction itself significantly change the oxytocin levels overall for either the dogs or the owners as a group.
Wait, no significant change overall?
No significant overall effect. There was huge variability between individuals. Sure, some dogs showed an increase, but many didn't. It wasn't the consistent universal effect that the popular narrative might lead you to believe.
That directly contradicts the simple cuddle your dog, get an oxytocin hit story. If the reward circuits are clearly firing, why is this specific chemical measure so inconsistent?
It's a really good question. Some researchers suggest the role of oxytocin in this specific bond might actually be somewhat overrated in public perception right now. There are likely methodological challenges, you know. Measuring hormones in urine can be tricky, influenced by lots of factors. But more fundamentally, the bond is probably regulated by a whole cocktail of neurochemicals and systems, dopamine, as we saw with the caudate activation, endorphins, maybe others, not just oxytocin.
So the picture is much broader, much more complex than just one single hormone loop.
Exactly. It's likely a much richer, more complex neurochemical symphony playing out, and focusing only on oxytocin might be missing a lot of the music.
Okay, so let's try and pull this all together. Where does this deep dive leave us?
It seems the more we learn from the science, the more amazing this relationship actually is. We've got evidence for deep genetic roots pushing dogs towards hypersociability, maybe even as an unintended consequence of just wanting them to be less fearful. We have brain imaging showing their reward systems prioritize us, our very scent, above almost everything else. And we see clear, measurable benefits for our emotional state when we interact with them, not just less stress, but more actual joy.
That's a great summary. And if we zoom out, it really highlights the need for careful interpretation. The behavior, the brain scans, they absolutely confirm how deep this attachment runs. But the varying results, like with oxytocin, are a good reminder for researchers and for all of us, really, to be cautious about latching onto overly simple explanations. The dog is clearly primed genetically and neurologically to bond with us. But the texture of that bond, the precise chemical underpinnings, it's still quite complex and maybe even a bit elusive. Which brings us back kind of full circle to that fMRI study, that finding about the caudate response, differentiating a specific human just by scent, even when they weren't physically present. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Is that positive association the dog feels for their person? Is it truly an abstract thing, like a distant reward they're anticipating? Could it be similar to how, you know, how we feel when we see a photo of someone we love who's far away, a kind of abstract warmth or longing?
Is the dog experiencing something akin to that abstract anticipation based purely on scent?
Yeah. It's definitely something for you to chew on next time you walk in the door and your dog greets you, maybe knowing exactly who else has been there just by the lingering smell.
Definitely food for thought. Until next time.